Rifeland is a vast, brightly lit space occupied by elementary shapes done up in primary colors. It is like being inside an educational toy designed to teach solid geometry to three-year-olds. Cubes, spheres, tetrahedrons, polyhedrons, connected with a web of cylinders and lines and helixes. But in this case, it has gone way, way out of control. As if every Tinker Toy set and Lego block ever made had been slapped together according to some long-forgotten scheme. Hero's been around the metaverse long enough to know that despite the bright, cheery appearance of this thing, it is in fact as simple and utilitarian as an army camp. This is a model of a system. A big, complicated system. The shapes probably represent computers or central nodes in Rife's worldwide network, or Pearly Gates franchises, or any other kind of local and regional offices that Rife has going around the world. By clambering over this structure and going into those bright shapes, Hero could probably uncover some of the code that makes Rife's network operate. He could perhaps try to hack it up, as Juanita suggested. But there is no point in messing with something he doesn't understand. He might waste hours fooling around with some piece of code only to find out that it was the software to control the automatic toilet flushers at Rife Bible College. So Hero keeps moving, keeps looking up at the tangle of shapes, trying to find a pattern. He knows now that he has found his way into the boiler room of the entire metaverse, but he has no idea what he's looking for. This system, he realizes, really consists of several separate networks all tangled together in the same space. There's an extremely complicated tangle of fine red lines, millions of them running back and forth between thousands of small red balls. Just as a wild guess, Hero figures that this may represent Rife's fiber optics network, with its innumerable local offices and nodes spread all over the world. There are a number of less complicated networks in other colors, which might represent coaxial lines, such as they used to use for cable television, or even voice phone lines. And there is a crude, heavily built, blocky network all done up in blue. It consists of a small number, fewer than a dozen, of big blue cubes. They are connected to each other, but nothing else, by massive blue tubes. The tubes are transparent, and inside of them, Hero can see bundles of smaller connections in various colors. It has taken Hero a while to see all of this, because the blue cubes are nearly obscured. They are all surrounded by little red balls and other small nodes, like trees being overwhelmed with kudzu. It appears to be an older, pre-existing network of some kind, with its own internal channels, mostly primitive ones like voice phone. Rife is patched into it heavily, with his own higher-tech systems. Hero maneuvers until he can get a closer look at one of the blue cubes, peering through the clutter of lines that has grown around it. The blue cube has a big white star on each of its six faces. "It's the government of the United States," Juanita says. "Where hackers go to die," Hero says. "The largest and yet the least efficient producer of computer software in the world." Hero and YT have eaten a lot of junk food together in different joints all over L.A. Donuts, burritos, pizza, sushi, you name it. And all YT ever talks about is her mother and the terrible job that she has with the feds. The regimentation, the lie detector tests. The fact that for all the work she does, she really has no idea what it is that the government is really working on. It's always been a mystery to Hero, too, but then that's how the government is. It was invented to do stuff that private enterprise doesn't bother with, which means that there's probably no reason for it. You never know what they're doing or why. Hackers have traditionally looked upon the government's coding sweatshops with horror and just tried to forget that all of that shit ever existed. But they have thousands of programmers. The programmers work 12 hours a day out of some twisted sense of personal loyalty. Their software engineering techniques, while cruel and ugly, are very sophisticated. They must have been up to something. Juanita? Yeah? Don't ask me why I think this, but I think that the government has been undertaking a big software development project for L. Bob Rife. Makes sense, she says. He has such a love-hate relationship with his programmers. He needs them, but he won't trust them. The government's the only organization he would trust to write something important. I wonder what it is. Hold on, Hero says. Hold on. He is now a stone's throw away from a big blue cube sitting at ground level. All the other blue cubes sort of feed into it. There is a motorcycle parked next to the cube, rendered in color, but just one notch above black and white. Big jaggedy pixels and a limited color palette. It has a sidecar, and Raven standing next to it. He is carrying something in his arms. It is another simple geometric construction, a long, smooth blue ellipsoid a couple of feet in length. From the way he's moving, Hero thinks that Raven has just removed it from the blue cube. He carries it over to the motorcycle and nestles it into the sidecar. The big one, Hero says. It's exactly what we were afraid of, Juanita says. Rife's revenge, headed for the amphitheater, where all the hackers are gathered in one place. Rife's going to infect all of them at once. He's going to burn their minds. Ambangala Manuralaria. 64. Raven's already on the motorcycle. If Hero chases him on foot, he might catch him before he reaches the street. But he might not. In that case, Raven would be on his way to downtown at tens of thousands of miles per hour, while Hero was still trying to get back to his own motorcycle. At those speeds, once Hero has lost sight of Raven, he's lost him forever. Raven starts his bike, begins maneuvering carefully through the tangle, headed for the exit. Hero takes off as fast as his invisible legs can carry him, headed straight for the wall. He punches through a couple of seconds later, runs back to the street. His tiny little invisible avatar can't operate the motorcycle, so he returns to his normal look, hops on his bike, and gets it turned around. Looking back, he sees Raven riding out towards the street, the logic bomb glowing a soft blue, like heavy water in a reactor. He doesn't even see Hero yet. Now's his chance. He draws his katana, aims his bike at Raven, pumps it up to 60 or so miles an hour. No point in coming in too fast. The only way to kill Raven's avatar is to take its head off. Running it over with the motorcycle won't have any effect. A security demon is running toward Raven, waving his arms. Raven looks up, sees Hero bearing down on him, and bursts forward. The sword cuts air behind Raven's head. It's too late. Raven must be gone now. But turning himself around, Hero can see him in the middle of the street. He slammed into one of the stanchions that holds up the monorail track, a perennial irritation to high-speed motorcyclists. Shit! Both of them say simultaneously. Raven gets turned toward downtown and twists his throttle just as Hero is pulling in behind him on the street, doing the same. Within a couple of seconds, they're both headed for downtown at something like 50,000 miles an hour. Hero's half a mile behind Raven, but can see him clearly. The streetlights have merged into a smooth twin streak of yellow, and Raven blazes in the middle, a storm of cheap color and big pixels. If I can take his head off, they're finished, Hero says. Gotcha, Juanita says. Because if you kill Raven, he gets kicked out of the system, and he can't sign back on until the graveyard demons dispose of his avatar. And I control the graveyard demons. So all I have to do is kill the bastard once. Once they get their choppers back to land, they'll have better access to the net. They can have someone else go into the metaverse and take over for him, Juanita warns. Wrong. Because Uncle Enzo and Mr. Lee are waiting for them on land. They have to do it during the next hour or never. YT suddenly wakes up. She hadn't realized that she was asleep. Something about the thwop of the rotor blades must have lulled her. She must be tired as shit is what it really is.
What the fuck is going on with my comnet?
Ilbob Rife is squalling.
No one answers, the Russian pilot says.
Not Raft, not L.A., not Houston. Get me LAX on the phone, then, Rife says. I want to take the jet to Houston. We'll get our butts over to the campus and find out what's going on.
The pilot messes around on his control panel.
Problem, he says.
What?
The pilot just shakes his head forlornly.
Someone is messing with the Skyphone. We're being jammed.
I might be able to get a line, the president says.
Rife just gives him a look like, right, asshole.
Anybody got a fucking quarter?
Rife hollers. Frank and Tony are startled for a minute.
We're going to have to touch down at the first payphone we see and make a goddamn phone call, he laughs. Can you believe that? Me? Using a telephone?
A second later, YT looks out the window and is blown away to see actual land down there and a two-lane highway winding its way down a warm sandy coastline. It's California. The chopper slows, cuts in closer to land, begins following the highway. Most of it is free of plastic and neon lights, but before long they home in on a short bit of franchise ghetto, built on both sides of the road in a place where it has cut away from the beach some distance. The chopper sits down in the parking lot of a buy and fly. Fortunately, the lot's mostly empty. They don't cut any heads off. A couple of youths are playing video games inside, and they barely look up at the astonishing sight of the chopper. She's glad. YT is totally embarrassed to be seen with this dull assortment of old farts. The chopper just sits there idling, while L. Bob Rife jumps out and runs over to the payphone bolted to the front wall. These guys were stupid enough to put her in the seat right next to the fire extinguisher. No reason not to take advantage of that fact. She jerks it out of its bracket, pulling out the safety pin in virtually the same motion, and squeezes the trigger, aiming it right into Tony's face. Nothing happens.
Fuck!
She shouts, and throws it at him, or rather, pushes it toward him. He's just leaning forward, grabbing at her wrist, and the impact of the extinguisher hitting his face is enough to put a major dent in his tude. Gives her enough time to swing her legs out of the chopper. Everything is getting fucked up. One of her pockets is zipped open, and as she's half-falling, half-rolling out of the chopper, the fire extinguisher bracket catches in that pocket and holds her. By the time she's gotten free of that, Tony's back, now on his hands and knees, reaching out for her arm. That she manages to avoid. She's running out freely into the parking lot. At the back, she's hemmed in by the buy-and-fly, along the sides by the tall border fence that separates this place from a Neo-Aquarian temple on one side and a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong franchulet on the other. The only way to escape is out onto the road, on the other side of the chopper. But the pilot and Frank and Tony have already jumped out and are blocking her exit out onto the road. Neo-Aquarian temple isn't going to help her. If she begs and pleads, they might just include her in their mantras next week. But Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is another story. She runs to the fence and starts trying to climb it. 8 feet of chain link with razor ribbon on top. But her clothing should stop the razor ribbon. Mostly. She gets about halfway up. Then pudgy but strong arms are around her waist. She's out of luck. L. Bob Rife lifts her right off the fence, both arms and both legs kicking the air uselessly. He backs up a couple of steps and starts carrying her back toward the chopper. She looks back at the Hong Kong franchise. It was a close thing. Someone's in the parking lot. A courier, cruising in off the highway, just kind of chilling out and taking it real easy.
Hey!
She screams. She reaches up and punches the lapel switch on her coverall, turning it bright blue and orange.
Hey! I'm a courier! My name's YT! These maniac scum guys kidnapped me!
Wow! The courier says. What a drag!
Then he asks her something, but she can't hear it because the helicopter is whirling up its blades.
They're taking me to LAX!
She screams at the top of her lungs. Then Rife slams her into the chopper face first. The chopper lifts off, tracked precisely by an audience of antennas on the roof of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. In the parking lot, the courier watches the chopper taking off. It's really cool to watch, and it has a lot of bumping guns on it. But those dudes inside of the chopper were harshing that chick major. The courier pulls his personal phone out of its holster, jacks into Radicea's central command, and punches a big red button. He calls a code. ...2,500 couriers are massed on the reinforced concrete banks of the L.A. River. Down in the bottom trench of the river, Vitali Chernobyl and the Meltdowns are just hitting the really good part of their next major hit single, Control Rod Jam. A number of the couriers are taking advantage of this soundtrack to style up and down the banks of the river. Only Vitali live can get their adrenaline pumping hard enough to enable them to skate a sharp bank at 80 miles per hour plus without doing a Wilson into the creek. And then the dark mass of Meltdown fans turn into a gyrating orange-red galaxy as 2,500 new stars appear. It's a mind-blowing sight, and at first they think it's a new visual effect put together by Vitali and his imageers. It is like a mass flicking of bics, except brighter and more organized. Each courier looks down on his or her belt to see that a red light is flashing on their personal telephone. Looks like some poor skater called in a code. In a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong franchise on the outskirts of Phoenix, Rat Thing number B-782 comes awake. Fido is waking up because the dogs are barking tonight. There is always barking. Much of the barking is very far away. Fido knows that faraway barks are not as important as close barks, and so he often sleeps through these. But sometimes a faraway bark will carry a special sound that makes Fido excited, and he can't help waking up. He is hearing one of those barks right now. It comes from far away, but it is urgent. Some nice doggy somewhere is very upset. He is so upset that his barking has spread to all the other doggies in the pack. Fido listens to the bark. He gets excited too. Some bad strangers have just been very close to a nice doggy's yard. They were in a flying thing. They had lots of guns. Fido doesn't like guns very much. A stranger with a gun shot him once and made him hurt. Then the nice girl came and helped him. These are extremely bad strangers. Any nice doggy in his right mind would want to hurt them and make them go away. As Fido listens to the bark, he sees what they look like and hears the way they sound. If any of these very bad strangers ever come to his yard, he will be extremely upset. Then Fido notices that the bad strangers are chasing someone. He can tell they are hurting her by the way her voice sounds and the way she moves. The bad strangers are hurting the nice girl who loves him. Fido gets more angry than he has ever been, even more angry than when a bad man shot him long ago. His job is to keep bad strangers out of his yard. He does not do anything else. But it's even more important to protect the nice girl who loves him. That is more important than anything, and nothing can stop him, not even the fence. The fence is very tall, but he can remember a long time ago when he used to jump over things that were taller than his head. Fido comes out of his doggy house, curls his long legs beneath him, and jumps over the fence around his yard before he has remembered that he is not capable of jumping over it. This contradiction is lost on him, though. As a dog, introspection is not one of his strong points. The bark is spreading to another place, far away. All the nice doggies who live in this faraway place are being warned to look out for the very bad strangers and the girl who loves Fido, because they are going to that place. Fido sees the place in his mind. It is big and wide and flat and open, like a nice field for chasing frisbees. It has lots of big flying things. Around the edges are a couple of yards where nice doggies live. Fido can hear those nice doggies barking in reply. He knows where they are, far away. But you can get there by streets. Fido knows a whole lot of different streets. He just runs down streets, and he knows where he is and where he's going. At first, the only trace that B-782 leaves of his passage is a dancing trail of sparks down the center of the franchise ghetto. But once he makes his way out onto a long, straight piece of highway, he begins to leave further evidence, a spume of shattered blue safety glass spraying outward in parallel veins from all four lanes of traffic as the windows and the windshields of the cars blow out of their frames, spraying into the air like rooster tails behind a speedboat. As part of Mr. Lee's good neighbor policy, all rat things are programmed never to break the sound barrier in a populated area. But Fido's in too much of a hurry to worry about the good neighbor policy. Jack the sound barrier. Bring the noise. '66. Raven, Hero says, let me tell you a story before I kill you.
I'll listen, Raven says. It's a long ride.
All vehicles in the metaverse have voice phones on them. Hero simply called home to the librarian and had him look up Raven's number. They are riding in lockstep across the black surface of the imaginary planet now, though Hero is gaining on Raven, meter by meter.
My dad was in the army in World War II. Lied about his age to get in. They put him in the Pacific doing scut work. Anyway, he got captured by the Nipponese.
So?
So they took him back to Nippon, put him in a prison camp. There were a lot of Americans there, plus some Brits and some Chinese, and a couple of guys that they couldn't place. They looked like Indians, spoke a little English, but they spoke Russian even better.
They were Aleuts, Raven says. American citizens. But no one had ever heard of them. Most people don't know that the Japanese conquered American territory during the war. Several islands at the end of the Aleutian chain, inhabited by my people. They took the two most important Aleuts and put them in prison camps in Japan. One of them was the mayor of Attu, the most important civil authority. The other was even more important to us. He was the chief harpooner of the Aleut nation.
Hero says, the mayor got sick and died. He didn't have any immunities, but the harpooner was one tough son of a bitch. He got sick a few times, but he survived. Went out to work in the fields along with the rest of the prisoners, growing food for the war effort. Worked in the kitchen preparing slop for the prisoners and the guards. He kept to himself a lot. Everyone avoided him because he smelled terrible. His bed stank up the barracks. He was cooking up aconite whale poison from mushrooms and other substances that he found in the fields and secreted in his clothing, Raven says. Besides, Hero continues, they were pissed at him because he broke out a window pane in the barracks once, and it let cold air in for the rest of the winter. Anyway, one day after lunch, all the guards became terribly sick. Whale poison in the fish stew, Raven says. The prisoners were already out working in the fields, and when the guards began to get sick, they began to march them all back in toward the barracks, because they couldn't keep watch over them when they were doubled over with stomach cramps. And this late in the war, it wasn't easy to bring in reinforcements. My father was last in the line of prisoners, and this Aleut guy was right in front of him. Raven says, as the prisoners were crossing an irrigation ditch, the Aleut dove into the water and disappeared. My father didn't know what to do, Hero says, until he heard a grunt from the guard who was bringing up the rear. He turned around and saw that this guard had a bamboo spear stuck all the way through his body, just came out of nowhere, and he still couldn't see the Aleut. Then another guard went down with his throat slit. And there was the Aleut, winding up and throwing another spear that brought down yet another guard. He had been making harpoons and hiding them under the water in the irrigation ditches, Raven says. Then my father realized, Hero continues, that he was doomed. Because no matter what he said to the guards, they would consider him to have been part of an escape attempt, and they would bring a sword and lop his head off. So, figuring that he might as well bring down a few of the enemy before they got to him, he took the gun from the first guard who had been hit, jumped down into the cover of the irrigation ditch, and shot another couple of guards who were coming over to investigate. Raven says, the Aleut ran for the border fence, which was a flimsy bamboo thing. There was supposedly a minefield there, but he ran straight across it with no trouble. Either he was lucky, or else the mines, if there were any, were few and far between. They didn't bother to have strict perimeter security, Hiro says, because Japan is an island. So even if someone escaped, where could they run to? An Aleut could do it, though, Raven says. He could go to the nearest coastline and build himself a kayak. He could take to the open water and make his way up the coastline of Japan, then surf from one island to the next, all the way back to the Aleutians. Right, Hiro says, which is the only part of the story that I never understood, until I saw you on the open water, outrunning a speedboat in your kayak. Then I put it all together. Your father wasn't crazy. He had a perfectly good plan. Yes, but your father didn't understand it. My father ran in your father's footsteps across the minefield. They were free. In Nippon, your father started heading downhill toward the ocean. My father wanted to head uphill into the mountains, figuring that they could maybe live in an isolated place until the war was over. It was a stupid idea, Raven says. Japan is heavily populated. There is no place where they could have gone unnoticed. My father didn't even know what a kayak was. Ignorance is no excuse, Raven says. They're arguing. The same argument we're having now was their downfall. The Nipponese caught up with them on a road just outside of Nagasaki. They didn't even have handcuffs, so they tied their hands behind their backs with bootlaces and made them kneel on the road facing each other. Then the lieutenant took his sword out of its sheath. It was an ancient sword. The lieutenant was from a proud family of samurai, and the only reason he was on this home front detail was that he had nearly had one leg blown off earlier in the war. He raised the sword up above my father's head. It made a high ringing sound in the air, Raven says, that hurt my father's ears. But it never came down. My father saw your father's skeleton kneeling in front of him. That was the last thing he ever saw. My father was facing away from Nagasaki, Hiro says. He was temporarily blinded by the light. He fell forward and pressed his face into the ground to get the terrible light out of his eyes. Then everything was back to normal again. Except my father was blind, Raven says. He could only listen to your father fighting the lieutenant. It was a half-blind, one-legged samurai with a katana versus a big, strong, healthy man with his arms tied behind his back, Hiro says. A pretty interesting fight. A pretty fair one. My father won, and that was the end of the war. The occupation troops got there a couple of weeks later. My father went home and kicked around for a while, and finally had a kid during the 70s. So did yours. Raven says, I'm Chitka, 1972. My father got nuked twice by you bastards. I understand the depth of your feelings, Hiro says. But don't you think you've had enough revenge? There's no such thing as enough, Raven says. Hiro guns his motorcycle forward and closes on Raven, swinging his katana. But Raven reaches back, watching him in the rearview mirror, and blocks the blow. He's carrying a big, long knife in one hand. Then Raven cuts his speed down to almost nothing and dives in between a couple of the stanchions. Hiro overshoots him, slows down too much, and gets a glimpse of Raven screaming past him on the other side of the monorail. By the time he's accelerated and cut through another gap, Raven has already slalomed over to the other side. And so it goes. They run down the length of the street in an interlacing zigzag pattern, cutting back and forth under the monorail. The game is a simple one. All Raven has to do is make Hiro run into a stanchion. Hiro will come to a stop for a moment. By that time, Raven will be gone, out of visual range, and Hiro will have no way to track him. It's an easier game for Raven than for Hiro. But Hiro's better at this kind of thing than Raven is. That makes it a pretty even match. They slalom down the monorail track at speeds from 60 to 60,000 miles per hour. All around them, low-slung commercial developments and high-tech labs
and amusement parks sprawl off into the darkness. Downtown is before them, as high and bright as the aurora borealis rising from the black water of the Bering Sea. '67. The first poon smacks into the belly of the chopper as they are coming in low over the valley. YT feels it rather than hears it. She knows that sweet impact so well that she can sense it, like one of those super-sensitive seismo thingies that detects earthquakes on the other side of the planet. Then half a dozen other poons strike in quick succession, and she has to force herself not to lean over and look out the window. Of course. The chopper's belly is a solid wall of Soviet steel. It'll hold poons like glue. If they just keep flying low enough to poon, which they have to keep the chopper under the Mafia's radar. She can hear the radio crackling up front.
Take it up, Sasha.
You're picking up some parasites. She looks out the window. The other chopper, the little aluminum corporate number, is flying alongside them, a little bit higher in the air, and all the people inside of it are peering out the windows, watching the pavement underneath them. Except for Raven. Raven is still goggled into the metaverse. Shit. The pilot's pulling the chopper to a higher altitude.
Okay, Sasha, you lost him, the radio says. But you still got a couple of them poon things hanging off your belly. So make sure you don't snag them on anything. The cables are stronger than steel.
That's all YT needs. She opens the door and jumps out of the chopper. At least that's how it looks to the people inside. Actually, she grabs a handhold on her way down and ends up dangling from the swinging open door, looking inward toward the belly of the chopper. A couple of poons are stuck to it. 30 feet below, she can see the handles dangling on the ends of their lines, fluttering in the airstream. Looking into the open door, she can't hear Rife, but she can see him sitting there next to the pilot, motioning, "Down, take it down." Which is what she figured. This hostage thing works two ways. She's no good to Rife unless he's got her, and she's in one piece. The chopper starts losing altitude again, heading back down toward the twin stripe of low glow that marks out the avenue beneath them. YT gets swinging back and forth on the door a little, finally swings in far enough that she can hook one of the poon cables with her foot. This next bit is going to hurt like hell, but the tough fabric of the coverall should prevent her from losing too much skin. And the sight of Tony lunging at her, trying to grab her sleeve, reinforces her own natural tendency not to think about it too hard. She lets go of the chopper's door with one of her hands, grabs the poon cable, winds it around the outside of her glove a couple of times, then lets go with the other hand. She was right. It does hurt like hell. As she swings down under the belly of the chopper, out of Tony's grasp, something pops inside her hand. Probably one of those dinky little bones. But she gets the poon cable wrapped around her body the same way Raven did when he rappelled off the ship with her, and manages a controlled burning slide down to the end. Down to the handle, that is. She hooks it onto her belt so she can't fall, and then thrashes around there for what seems like a whole minute until she's not tangled up in the cable anymore, just dangling by the waist, twisting around and around between the chopper and the street, out of control. Then she gets the handle in both hands and unhooks it from her belt, so she's hanging by the arms again, which was the whole point of the exercise. As she rotates, she sees the other chopper above her and off to the side, glimpses the faces watching her, knows that all of this is being relayed over the radio to Rife. Sure enough, the chopper cuts to about half its former speed, loses some altitude. She clicks another control and reels out the line all the way to the end, dropping 20 feet in one thrill-packed moment. Now she's flying along, 10 or 15 feet above the highway, doing maybe 45 miles an hour. The logo signs shoot past her on either side like meteors. Other than a swarm of couriers, traffic is light. The rare chopper comes thwacking in, dangerously close, and she looks up at it just for an instant and sees Raven looking at her through the window. He's pulled his goggles up on his forehead just for a second. He's got a certain look on his face,
and she realizes that he's not pissed at her at all. He loves her. She lets go of the handle and goes into freefall. At the same time, she jerks the manual release on her cervical collar and goes into full Michelin Man mode as tiny gas cartridges detonate in several strategic locations around her bod. The biggest one goes off like an M80 at the nape of her neck, unfurling the coverall's collar into a cylindrical gas bag that shoots straight up and encases her entire head. Other airbags go off around her torso and her pelvis, paying lots of attention to that spinal column. Her joints are already protected by the armor gel. Which is not to say that it doesn't hurt when she lands. She can't see anything because of the airbag around her head, of course. But she feels herself bouncing at least 10 times. She skids for a quarter of a mile and apparently caroms off several cars along the way. She can hear their tires squealing. Finally, she goes butt first through someone's windshield and ends up sprawled across their front seat. They veer into a Jersey barrier. The airbag deflates as soon as everything stops moving, and she claws it away from her face. Her ears are ringing or something. She can't hear anything. Maybe she busted her eardrums when the airbags went off. But there's also the question of the big chopper, which has a talent for making noise. She drags herself out onto the hood of the car, feeling little hunks of safety glass beneath her, carving parallel scratches into the paint job. Rife's big Soviet chopper is right there, hovering about 20 feet above the avenue, and by the time she sees it, it has already accumulated a dozen more poons. Her eyes follow the cables down to street level, and she sees couriers straining at the lines. This time, they're not letting go. Rife gets suspicious, and the chopper gains altitude, lifting the couriers off their planks. But a passing double-bottom semi sheds a small army of couriers. There must be 100 of them pooned onto the poor thing. And within a few seconds, all their magna poons are airborne, and at least half of them stick to the armor plating on the first try. The chopper lurches downward until all of the couriers are on the ground again. 20 more couriers come flying in and nail it. Those that can't, grab onto someone else's handle and add their weight. The chopper tries several times to rise, but it may as well be tethered to the asphalt by this point. It starts to come down. The couriers fan out away from it so that the chopper comes down in the middle of a radial burst of poon cables. Tony, the security guy, climbs down out of the open door, moving slowly, high-stepping his way through the web of cables, but somehow retaining his balance and his dignity. He walks away from the chopper until he is out from under the rotor blades, then pulls an Uzi out from under his windbreaker and fires a short airburst.
"Get the fuck away from our chopper!" he is shouting.
The couriers, by and large, do. They're not stupid. And YT is now walking around safe on the pavement. The mission is accomplished. The code is finished. There's no reason to hassle these chopper dudes anymore. They detach their poons from the belly of the chopper and reel in the cables. Tony looks around and sees YT. She's walking directly toward the chopper. Her sprained body moves awkwardly.
"Get back in the chopper, you lucky bitch," he says.
YT picks up a loose poon handle that no one has bothered to reel in yet. She hits the button that turns off the electromagnet, and its head drops off the chopper's armor. She reels it in until about 4 feet of slack is there between the reel and the head. "There was this dude named Ahab that I read about," she says, whirling the poon around her head. "He got his poon cable all wrapped up around the thing he was trying to poon. It was a big mistake." She lets the poon fly. It passes up through the plane of the rotor blades, near the center, and she could see the unbreakable cable start to wind itself around the delicate parts of the rotor's axle, like a garrote around the ballerina's neck. Through the chopper's windshield, she can see Sasha reacting, flipping switches frantically, pulling levers, his mouth making a long string of Russian curses. The poon's handle gets snapped out of her hand, and she sees it get whipped into the center like it's a black hole. "I guess he just didn't know when to let go. Like some people," she says. Then she turns around and walks away from the chopper. Behind her, she can hear large pieces of metal going the wrong way.
running into one another at high speed. Reif has figured it out a long time ago. He's already running down the middle of the highway with a submachine gun in one hand, looking for a car to commandeer. Above, the rare chopper hovers and watches. Reif looks up to it and motions forward with one hand, shouting,
"Go to LAX! Go to LAX!"
The chopper makes one last orbit over the scene, watching as Sasha puts the ruined gunship into cold shutdown, watching furious couriers overwhelming and disarming Tony and Frank and the president, watching as Reif stands in the middle of the left lane and forces a Cosa Nostra pizza car to a stop, forces the driver out. But Raven isn't watching any of these things. He's looking out the window at YT. And as the chopper finally tilts forward and accelerates into the night, he grins at her and gives her the thumbs up. YT bites her lower lip and flips him the bird. With that, the relationship is over, hopefully for all time. YT borrows a plank from an odd skater and pushes herself across the street to the nearest buy-and-fly and starts trying to call Mom for a ride home.